Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you? And I want to actually kick things off with asking you why newsletters are back, which
newsletters are
what we were just talking about.
We were, well, because we usually talk about like what we discuss in our newsletter on this pod. So if you don't subscribe to that newsletter, you should newsletter.coinbits.app, and you can subscribe. It's a weekly newsletter. And we use Beehive as our newsletter platform. It's been really good experience. And like newsletters are so back. You know, I think part of the reason is it is based on sort of this open protocol, like the web, right? It's like email. People have been burned so many times building up a follower count on social media and then getting shut down or having the social media platform disrupted in some way and then losing all of this work that they put in. So you see people on social media posting things like, you have to subscribe to my newsletter so we can stay in touch in case, you know, I'm kicked off this platform. Like, everyone's always begging you, please give me your email address. Because if you have the email, that's your follower account that you can move anywhere. So it's very powerful. It kind of goes around all these platforms. It's so interesting that newsletters are kind of back. I barely ever read blogs. You know what? You know when I stopped reading blogs? It was a few months ago when I realized all my favorite blogs, every post is reporting on what's going on social media, and mostly X. It'll be like the headline says this person did this or said that, and then there will be an introductory paragraph, and then there will be an embedded tweet, and then there will be a commentary, and then there'll be another embedded tweet, and then there'll be a commentary. I'm like, why don't I just go on Twitter and like follow this person, you know? And that's everything now. I mean, there's very little, some Substack, right? But Substack's basically a newsletter. So really, like, newsletters are where people are going to write interesting things in long form. They're all also long form tweets, but I think newsletters are really powerful because, again, they let you build up this list of subscribers that you can use to your advantage, you know, in many different ways.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, like, it's interesting because some newsletters are like I don't know if I would call Arthur Hayes's blog posts like newsletters. Like they're kind of like an in between long form, but it's like about the news, and that's
an exception though. He's still blogging.
Yeah. Like medium posts. Those are still blogging. I don't read those as much anymore. He is an exception.
Yeah. He's great.
But yeah, I agree. Like, I read a ton of newsletters.
Yeah.
And like more than I used to, probably.
Oh, me too. No, they're back. Yeah. I mean, it's like a movement online. Like, everybody subscribes to a few newsletters, and there's also new tools now for discovering other newsletters. So like that problem of kind of being stuck in a box is being solved by smarter tools like Beehive and others that allow newsletters to cross promote each other and link to each other. There's even one click subscribes in some cases. And so I think there will be a need for smarter like email clients that manage your newsletters for you in more of in a way that it feels more like you're reading an RSS feed or you're browsing something that looks more like what is the name? Flipboard or Feedly, these other kinds of like graphical remember Flipboard?
Yeah. I'm like, whoa, people still use Flipboard. Actually.
They do. Yeah. But imagine that, I don't know, maybe they have this already and I'm talking from a place of ignorance, but something like Flipboard, but for your newsletters would be really cool.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. But speaking of which, so newsletters are also, you know, we were talking about people getting kicked off social media. And that's why newsletters are popular. Well, that has to do with this broader problem that we're facing now with surveillance and privacy. And this was a big week for attacks on privacy and kind of advocating for increased surveillance on the part of the United States government, law enforcement, and regulators have made it clear through a series of actions, which, you know, it could be coincidental that every single day there's a new thing that happens, but it seems very much like drip, 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 right? It's like kind of a PR campaign that's perfectly spaced out so that each day there's the news cycle on social media where everyone's talking about the latest, from my perspective, the latest outrage. But this last week was a huge week for all of this. So do you want to get us started? Like what happened this week? Summarize it for us. There's so much.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that happened, I think, well, Samurai was last week, right? So just filling everybody in, Samurai, the founders were arrested and charged with a couple of things that warrant, you know, like 20 years in prison potentially. And this week, this week, Wasabi, which is also a mixing service, they exited the United States. And in addition to that, Block, after last week releasing that they basically had like a kind of like a DCA service for businesses that used Square, and that they were mining, and they had a new mining chip to decentralize mining, because that's a thing that people are definitely concerned with. So Block goes all in on Bitcoin. Jack Dorsey, he writes in his shareholder letter, Q1 shareholder letter, like explaining why he's going all in on Bitcoin. It's very powerful. And then this week, Block gets, you know, there's news that breaks that Block is being investigated for certain like Block users being in, you know, jurisdictions like Iran, and that's a big no-no and anti-money laundering concerns, et cetera. So they're being investigated for that. Wow. And so I think that, and it's, I think it's like a federal probe is what it is. And so I think that what's interesting is that any financial services institution could face this. You would imagine that that there's anyone that's in business for like a year likely has some customers pass through the you know, that are like not allowed, right? Or that like wouldn't otherwise be allowed. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, so there has built up a system of compliance and an industry around compliance over the last 10, 20 years in order to satisfy these requirements. And the problem isn't the requirements so much. Well, there's two problems. Number one, so even going into the conversation, as soon as you start talking about a conversation about money laundering, you already are faced with the difficulty in defining money laundering. So money laundering is a crime. It's not that old, though. I think I was reading that the first legislation passed that contained that term was in the 80s. So it's not like this ancient problem. Actually, until then, before the United States could credibly sort of control the global flows of money and had enough surveillance technology to be able to and kind of reach into the banks to be able to do anything about money laundering, it just wasn't an issue. It was just assumed that money is like electricity. It can, or like speech, it can be used for good or bad, and you prosecute the crime. You prosecute the thing people are doing, not the tool. Well, what happened in the 80s is that started to change with the term money laundering. And so now it's a crime. And I'm not taking a stand today in this podcast when I explain this, whether I think money laundering is a crime or not. What I'm saying is it's a crime, and companies and people who deal in financial flows are required to build out a compliance infrastructure, which includes people reviewing transactions and technology that's often automated in order to protect money that is moving in and out of these financial institutions' bank accounts from having an origination or a destination that is from an illegal, that causes an illegal transaction. Now that could be because the person or the entity is on the OFAC list, so they're sanctioned by the United States government. It could be that they are using the funds in a way to fund a crime, or they have a sanctioned address. In the case of Bitcoin, the United States government actually publish Bitcoin addresses that are sanctioned. Interesting, because you can generate a new address for every Bitcoin transaction. So it seems like that's kind of going to go away as people learn how to use Bitcoin better. Those who want to use it for money laundering are going to find out that they don't need to use sanctioned addresses to do it. So, but I think that the problem here, putting aside whether money laundering is or should be a crime, it is a crime. There's also the question of what's called overcompliance, and this is a big problem in the Bitcoin industry, the cryptocurrency industry, and actually the financial industry in general, because what has happened over the last couple of decades is the United States government has shown that it is very willing to use its control over money flows to implement its policies and to pressure individuals and companies and governments into kind of bending to U.S. interests. And so they also have been changing the rules at a pretty rapid pace. So, you know, it almost seems like every month there's new guidance or new regulations or laws that come down that kind of change what you're allowed to do with dollars. And the problem with that is, because it's changing so fast, now there's this concept of what is called overcompliance. So what that means is companies and institutions look and say, okay, what I'm doing now may not be wrong or not be crossing the line or not be on the wrong side of the US government's preferences or regulators or law enforcement preferences. But because it could be soon, I'm going to kind of anticipate where we're going with this and say, I'm going to lock down my platform even more than is required, because I don't want trouble in the future and I don't want to have to answer for anything. I just want to be kind of like left alone to run my business. I don't want trouble. I don't want to, like, I'm not here to kind of challenge the government and, take a stand on any kind of issue. I just want to run my business. So what these institutions do is they overcomply. So they say, oh, I'm not required to share all this data with you, Mr. Regulator or government official, but I'm going to send it to you anyway. I'm going to collect it anyway. Like KYC, for example, there's no clear law about what you need to collect about people to open a financial account. There is a responsibility for institutions to know their customer, but how they need to know their customer isn't really defined. And so what companies are doing is they're saying, well, I don't know where the line is, so I just need to hoover up as much information about my customers as possible. I'm going to take pictures of their ID. I'm going to take pictures of their face. I'm going to do even background checks. There's even something that's very nefarious, which is called adverse media. So this, I am going to say here on this podcast, I think that that's a very dangerous idea that has somehow seeped into the compliance practices of a lot of companies. And what that means is there are these databases that where you can search people's identity. You can search by like social security number or name, some kind of reasonable amount of data about them to kind of be confident that this is the same person. You search that database and that database will spit out a result about whether this person has been involved in what's called adverse media, which kind of just means they lost a popularity contest online. They have, you know, negative news stories written about them, or they were involved in some kind of scandal that is all over the place. And so, right. So what happens is, as a financial institution, I don't want drama, right? So I search for adverse media. And if this person has adverse media exposure, I'm just not going to give them an account. The tiny amount of margin I could get from this one person is not worth the headache of having to defend myself publicly about why I gave this person an account. So that's all part of this kind of overcompliance that institutions are now engaging in. And that is that's a big part of the story right now with Bitcoin. So for example, when Async, which is the company that makes the wallet called Phoenix, which is a very good and pretty successful non-custodial Lightning wallet that a lot of people used, including me, when they looked at what happened with Samurai, so Async doesn't do coordination of coin joins. They don't do anything like that. But they look at all of these recent actions and they say, you know what? US is a big market, but there's a whole world out there. And I don't want to expose myself to kind of the long arm of the law in the United States where, you know, you could be in another country and still be affected by United States regulations or laws or law enforcement. It's not worth it to me. I just want to like run my business without the drama. And so I'm just not going to serve the United States. I'm going to over comply. They haven't told me it's not allowed, but I can kind of, I don't know if it's allowed. They're not going to tell me it is allowed. And so like the US government uses that ambiguity to their advantage because they can kind of create this chilling effect that just sort of forces companies to over comply without having to, you know, if they actually gave this guidance and made it clear in the letter of the law, then they would be open to lawsuits and discussions about the constitutionality of this. Like, you know, is this speech? Is this property? Like, they're happier to keep it ambiguous for now. And so it's caused this overcompliance movement that happened with Async. And then this week, you just mentioned Wasabi Wallet. So that's run by a company called ZK Snacks. And they have just announced that they are no longer going to provide CoinJoin services. So again, CoinJoin hasn't been explicitly made illegal, but they're just like, you know what? I don't need this. So they're stopping that. And that was an important service for Bitcoiners. You mentioned this last week. It's really important to remember privacy is not a crime. And the estimation for how many money laundering transactions were being executed on Samurai's CoinJoin platform is lower than 10%. I think it was like 4 or 6%, really low. So everybody else who was using that platform and was getting a benefit from it, first, it doesn't matter if they're getting a benefit from it, they're free people. But second, they do have a right to privacy, right? We've been told that there's this penumbra coming out of the First Amendment that implies privacy. Or was it I don't know which amendment it was, but you know, going all the way back to Roe v. Wade, there's this the fourth amendment,
there, right?
It implies that we have a right to privacy. So that's like jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. So 95% of the people using this in order to obtain privacy in a free country where that's not illegal have just been shut out of the opportunity to do that. And so, that's not cool. Like that's not good. And now with Wasabi closing down, it's really not good. I just saw this morning, I think you retweeted or you shared a tweet from Snowden. Somebody did, Edward Snowden, saying it's really time for it. Tell me, it's about privacy. And it's like Bitcoin has not done a good enough job ensuring privacy at the base layer.
Yeah, because I think that's interesting because I think it represents an escalation on the side of the Bitcoin community in response to government action. And it also, if something were adopted by like, you know, consensus, like some sort of BIP, then that would I think it would get crazy because I think that institutions that hold Bitcoin in an ETF would not want, like, you know, all these privacy upgrades if the government is saying like say there's a scenario where the federal government says your ETF is like revoked if Bitcoin changes to become this. And like, I mean, I think things could get crazy.
That is true.
That happens.
Yeah, because like,
Michael Saylor, like, you know, he has billions of Bitcoin at Coinbase, and like they're holding this conference about like institutional adoption of Bitcoin in treasuries, and like those, you know, I'm sure most people at those companies want Bitcoin to have these privacy features. I think we all would, but if it implies a fight, sometimes they don't like, I don't think that everybody wants to fight as much as Edward Snowden. And therefore, right. like the lines will be drawn a little bit differently. And I think that that could represent an escalation on multiple fronts, or lead to an just a lot of escalation.
Well, and we don't have to fear the escalation. I think that you made a great point when you dug up another conversation happening online about comparing what may happen imminently now with Bitcoin to the cryptography wars of the 1990s. That's a really interesting point.
Yeah, it is. It is, but I agree that like we have the rights and everything. I think that there is the potential for short-term pain if there's like a debate around like consensus level changes and there are fierce opponents to it, then I think that like the idea that this is like the best savings vehicle forever, I think that a lot of newcomers will be turned off potentially. So in terms of like short-term mass ownership increases, I think that that there could be some like negative implications, but I think that long-term, like regardless of whatever happens, yeah, I think that Bitcoiners often have the courts on our side, but we don't have the government on our side, like the other branches, right? Mm. Besides, unless there's like a change in administration.
I agree. I mean, so the courts seem to be, the courts are the reason that the cryptography wars went the way of that they did, which benefited everybody. And for those that don't know that story, in the early 1990s, when cryptography, encryption technology was invented that became accessible to end consumers, and it was mature enough that it could be integrated into consumer software and mobile devices. Like that was the beginning of cell phones, that was the beginning of email. And there was this new encryption technology that could be used where you and I could have a completely private conversation that was digital. So before cryptography, or even today, you can still send a message in the clear, and when you broadcast that message onto the internet, it will find, if I chat with you in a way that's not encrypted, I broadcast what I say to you, it hops around all these servers on the internet and it finds its way to your device, and then when it finds its way, you read it. Well, every hop on those servers are an opportunity for that message to be read by anybody else who has access to that server. And, you know, the NSA and these government agencies, they either had kind of default access to some of these, or they wanted the ability to like subpoena one of those servers and get those messages, because they, in their mind, were fighting these existential national security threats at all times. And so when we have encryption technology, what that means is when I send you an email, my device encrypts it, it becomes completely illegible to anybody in between, but your device can decrypt it and read it. This was considered possibly something that was too dangerous for everyday Americans to have access to. And we think about it as ridiculous now, but at the time, it didn't have to break that way. It could have been continued to be classified. At the time, it was actually classified as a munition. So it was like a weapon that maybe was not protected, but by the Second Amendment, it was not something that Americans should have. And so this went through the courts, and ultimately this very important jurisprudence was arrived at, which still resonates, like is still kind of propagating today through these conversations, which is that code is speech, that code, computer code, is considered a form of speech and protected speech under the First Amendment. And so there's really no way to make an encryption algorithm illegal, because you're making a math equation illegal, or you're making computer code illegal. You can't do that. And so, you know, the privacy advocates won that fight. And now privacy is expected by default in communications. It's not something that is considered like on its face suspicious that you would want privacy. You even have, you know, you have popular messaging apps like iMessage, which everyone uses, WhatsApp, Signal, and they all use encryption. So that was like, that went well, right? So that gives me hope because we can point to that and say, first of all, there is precedence for this kind of fight to be won by privacy advocates. And second of all, the jurisprudence that was produced by that whole period is to our advantage as well. So I don't think, I would rather not have this confrontation. And it may not turn out well, but if we're going to have it, I think we're on very solid ground when we look back at the 1990s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And also like the world didn't end when people got encrypted messaging.
Right.
Right. Like the crazy threat didn't really occur. And I think that this reminded me, have you ever seen the movie Scarface? You know the scene where they're just bringing in boatloads of cash, like just the duffel bags of cash into the bank?
Yeah.
I remember seeing that and thinking, wow, are they like, how can they do that? That's crazy. And I think that that is what's wrong with our, with at least like my generation, that like we think that that is, that in it of itself is like a sketchy behavior to just like, you know, walk around with a ton of cash and like, you know, bring barrels of cash into a bank. And I think that that's, we have to like accept that that's okay, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's funny that you bring up Scarface because that was like, that was cash.
That was actually criminal money.
Stained by blood, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was like the worst form of criminality. But what you're saying is just, this is from a previous era where it was just acceptable that it was accepted that money was a form of communication,
mm-hmm.
and a form of kind of free. It was free from surveillance, but there are examples that are similar that are kind of more that are kind of sadder. So I was reading a news story a few weeks ago about a man who was pulled over by the police. You know, I don't know if there's something wrong with his tags or whatever. He happened to be a minority and he happened to be an independent journeyman who dealt in cash, and he carried by his own choice, you know, he had like $30,000 in his car, and he was like, I like cash. I deal in cash. That's just my preference. Cash is something that the United States government provides to its citizens as a service that we all, you know, we pay taxes for these little rectangles to be printed so that we can use them. I'm choosing to use them here. And the police couldn't believe it. They're like, where did you get this? Like, why are you using cash? Like, it's inherently suspicious. So it's just like saying cryptography, using encryption is inherently suspicious because you would never want to use it if you had nothing to hide, which is absolutely not true. Now they're saying you would never want to use cash unless you had something to hide. And that's absolutely not true either. And this man had his money confiscated. Like, they took his money, his life savings, and I think he finally eventually got them back after a long court battle, and he was represented by these privacy advocate attorneys. But nobody wants to deal with any of this. We don't want to have these confrontations. We just want to be left alone to go about our business and do business. And it's like people are being targeted in a way that is extremely unfair. And I really hope that financial privacy is something that is sort of restored and revived through this process of confrontation in these next few months and years.
Yeah, definitely. And I know that Reason Magazine does a very good job of highlighting cases like that with what's it called? Like civil asset forfeiture or something? Yeah, yeah. It's a horrible practice. It happens all the time. I think that like, these people are public servants. My like theme of the week has been like mentally reminding myself that all these people that are like, you know, targeting all these, this like industry I work in, that like, they're supposed to be public servants. Like,
right.
They need to act like it, you know? It's like,
well, right. And not only that, but the regulations and the laws that are passed are supposedly with the consent of the governed. So are they? We'll find out. I mean, I haven't done the polling. It could be that, you know, the vast majority of Americans are against financial privacy and wish to be surveilled 24/7. Like, it could be, I guess.
Not at all.
And I doubt it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that, that example that you brought up earlier about, adverse media.
Yeah.
That sounds like a social credit score to me.
It is very comfortable.
It totally is. So.
It totally is. Yep. It probably is a number actually, because for it to surface, it has to be kind of quantified and then a threshold has to be passed for it to be, you know, for it to be raised to the level of being presented to a compliance officer. So you're right. It is a social credit score. That's a really, really good point. We should just start
kind
calling it that.
KYC, like that whole process is kind of like that. So,
well, KYC is an input into adverse media, but it's surveillance that results in a decision. The social credit score, the reason it's so nefarious is it controls what you can do. It controls what services are available to you and what products are available to you and what you're allowed to do in this society. And you're exactly right. There are, you know, listen, I'm not an apologist at all for the types of people that find themselves in this situation, but I was shocked. So just a short digression. I live in a smallish town in middle America. So every town USA, Main Street USA, okay? Not a big city, anything like that. And the other night I was walking my dog and I heard a big bang and all our power went out. And we have a lot of power infrastructure over here. And I assume, okay, it was probably a transformer that blew up. So I went and I opened the Citizen app on my phone, which I haven't used in a long time, but I just wanted to see, did anybody report anything? And I saw that there's this feature to see sex offenders. Okay. And because we have the sex offender registry in the United States and you can click it. And then there's just dots everywhere. Again, I'm not in a big city, but there's just like hundreds of little orange dots. And when you click them, you can see somebody's picture and their name and what they did. And this is a form of public shaming. And I'm not saying these people don't deserve shame, but there's that's a system that has now in place and that can now be reused. It's like a framework. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if that becomes used for other things. And that's also a social credit score. That is a collection of low social credit score people that you can surface on a map. I don't like that at all. I mean, as much as I'd want to protect my kids from sexual predators, I don't like seeing that. It was very disturbing.
That's super disturbing. It's like, do you believe in restorative justice, right? Or like redemption or forgiveness? I don't know. Maybe not like, you know, forgiveness is not the right word, but like, you know, they've served their time. Like,
And it's like, it's
even putting aside that specific act, like the usage of technology for those reasons. And there is like academic, there are a lot of like academic studies and like public shaming is a tool. Like they're like that is for public shaming and they've, but I don't know how I feel about it. And I also, I agree that it's like scary to think of public shaming for like social credit scores and stuff like that. So
anyway, not the most uplifting episode today, but really important issues.
Yes.
I see them coming to the fore. I also, you know, there's also hope I want to say at the state level. So you mentioned that the courts tend to fall on the side of liberty in these cases, which is great. And we are probably going to have to rely on them to do that again. However, what's different between now and the 1990s is we're seeing a real resurgence of people who are concerned about issues relating to liberty, who are finding that the mechanism of state government is a path to that. And across many different fields. In Bitcoin, though, I just want to shout out a group that does really good work. I'm not affiliated with them. I do support them financially in a minor way. And I'd like to get more involved with them, which is Satoshi Action Fund. So that's Dennis Porter's nonprofit that is helping educate lawmakers and pass pro-Bitcoin, or at least legislation that protects the individual rights of citizens of states to use Bitcoin. There's a bill in the Tennessee working its way through a Tennessee legislative process, which does three things. It protects the mining industry from being kind of singled out as different from any kind of other electricity consumer or business. So no specific rules can be made against miners. They just have to follow the rules that all businesses have to follow. It's number one. Number two, it affirms, I wouldn't say protects because I think it's a natural right, but it affirms the rights of individuals in Tennessee to run a node, a Bitcoin node, and prevents laws passed to prevent, you know, to constrict that right. And then it also affirms or protects the right of individual citizens in Tennessee to own their own private keys, have Bitcoin in self-custody. And that's working its way through. It's not passed.
Wow.
There have been similar bills, though, all the way across the United States, across many, many different states that are that have either been passed or are in process. And so I'm hoping that part of this showdown about privacy, we may be able to kind of use the heft of federalism as a tool to protect liberty in this case.
Very cool. As the founders intended, although it's funny, there's like there's that tension, like Madison and all these people, they wanted to like federalism to work just because of like the rules. Mm-hmm. But there's that tension, there's like people within the rules. So there's like, you have to have good statesmen and women, or else like your framework, a lot of people want to rely just on the framework, but the framework alone is insufficient.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we have to have good people too.
I agree. I think we do have good people though. Yeah. I think we sometimes overlook how good of a strong civil society we still have. So hopefully that's also an asset.
Yes. We ended on a white pill. Let's go. Yeah. Woohoo.
Well, it's another week next week. Let's see what happens. But yes. Thank you for an interesting conversation. And have a great weekend, everyone.
Yep.
Talk to you later. Bye.